Chapter 6. That night, after the boys had gone to bed, Thomas Hudson and Roger Davis sat up in the big room talking. It had been too rough to do much goggle fishing, and after supper the boys had gone off with Joseph to go snapper fishing. They had come back tired and happy and said goodnight and gone to bed. The men had heard them talking for a while, and then they were asleep. Andrew was afraid of the dark, and the other boys knew it, but they never teased him about it. "Why do you think he's afraid of the dark?" Roger asked. "I don't know," Thomas Hudson said. "Weren't you?" "I don't think so." "I was," Thomas Hudson said. "Is it supposed to mean anything?" "I don't know," Roger said. "I was afraid of dying and that something would happen to my brother." "I didn't know you had a brother. Where is he?"
"Dead," Roger said.
"I'm sorry."
"You don't need to be. It was when we were kids."
"Was he older than you?"
"A year younger."
"What was it?"
"A canoe turned over with us."
"How old were you?"
"About 12.
"Don't talk about it if you don't want to."
"I'm not sure it did me a lot of good," Roger said.
"Didn't you know about it, really?"
"Never."
"For a long time, I thought everybody in the world knew about it.
It's strange when you're a boy."
"The water was too cold, and he let go. But what it added up to was that I came back, and he didn't."
"Poor bloody Roger."
"No," said Roger. "But it was early to learn about that stuff, and then I loved him very much, and I'd always been afraid something would happen to him. The water was cold for me, too, but I couldn't say that."
"Where was it?"
"Up in Maine. I don't think my father ever forgave me, although he tried to understand it. I've wished it was me every day since, but that's hardly a career."
"What was your brother's name?"
"Dave."
"Hell.
Is that why you wouldn't go goggle fishing today?"
"I guess so, but I'm going every other day. You never work those things out, though."
"You're grown up enough not to talk that way."
"I tried to go down after him, but I couldn't find him," Roger said. "It was too deep and it was really cold."
"David Davis," Thomas Hudson said.
"Yes. In our family, the first one is called Roger and the second one David."
"Rog, you did get over it, though."
"No," Roger said. "You never get over it, and sooner or later I have to tell it. I'm ashamed of that the way I'm ashamed of the fight on the dock."
"You had nothing to be ashamed of there."
"Yes, I did."
"I told you once, let's not get into that."
"All right.
I'm not going to have any more fights. Ever."
"You never fight. And you can fight as well as I can."
"I can't fight as well as you, but I just made up my mind I wouldn't fight.
I'm not going to fight, and I'm going to be some good and quit writing junk."
"That's the best thing I've heard you say," Thomas Hudson said.
"You think I could write something that would be worth a damn?"
"You could try."
"What did you quit painting for?"
"Because I couldn't kid myself any longer. I can't kid myself any longer on the writing either."
"What are you going to do, practically?"
"Go someplace and write a good straight novel as well as I can write it."
"Why don't you stay here and write?"
"You can stay on here after the boys are gone. It's too hot to write in your place."
"I wouldn't bother you too much?"
"No, Rog, I get lonely too, you know. You can't just run away from everything all the time."
"This sounds like a speech. I'll cut it out."
"No, go on. I need it."
"If you're going to start work, start here."
"You don't think out west would be better?"
"Any place is good. The thing is, not to run from it."
"No, any place isn't good," Roger objected. "I know that. They're good and then they go bad."
"Sure, but this is a good place now. Maybe it won't always be, but it's fine now. You'd have company when you quit work, and so would I. We wouldn't interfere with each other, and you could really bite on the nail."
"Do you truly think I could write a novel that would be any good?"
"You never will if you don't try.
You told me a hell of a good novel tonight if you wanted to write it. Just start with the canoe and end at how. Make it up after the canoe."
"Hell," Roger said. "I'm so corrupted that if I put in a canoe, it would have a beautiful Indian girl in it that young Jones, who is on his way to warn the settlers that Cecil B. DeMille is coming, would drop into, hanging by one hand to a tangle of vines that covers the river while he holds his trusty flintlock old Betsy in the other hand, And the beautiful Indian girl says, "Jones, it is you. Now we can make love as our frail craft moves towards the falls that someday will be Niagara."
"No," said Thomas Hudson. "You could just make the canoe and the cold lake and your kid brother, David Davis, 11, and afterwards, and then make up from there to the end."
"I don't like the end," Roger said.
"I don't think any of us do, really," Thomas Hudson said, "but there's always an end."
"Maybe we better knock off talking," Roger said. "I'm liable to start thinking about the novel."
"Tommy, why is it fun to paint well and hell to write well?
I never painted well, but it was fun, even the way I painted."
"I don't know," Thomas Hudson said.
"Maybe in painting, the tradition and the line are clearer, and there are more people helping you. Even when you break from the straight line of great painting, it's always there to help you."
"I think another thing is that better people do it," Roger said. "If I were a good enough guy, maybe I could have been a good painter. Maybe I'm just enough of a son of a bitch to be a good writer."
"That's the worst oversimplification I've ever heard."
"I always oversimplify," Roger maintained. "That's one reason I'm no damn good."
"Let's go to bed."
"I'll stay up and read a while," Roger said.
They slept well, and Thomas Hudson did not wake when Roger came out to the sleeping porch late in the night. After breakfast, the wind was light, and there were no clouds in the sky, and they organized for a day of underwater fishing.
"You're coming, aren't you, Mr. Davis?" Andrew asked.
"I most certainly am."
"That's good," said Andrew. "I'm glad."
"How do you feel, Andy?" Thomas Hudson asked.
"Scared," said Andrew, "like always. But I'm not so scared with Mr. Davis going."
"Never be scared, Andy," Roger said. "It's worthless. Your father told me."
"They tell you," Andrew said. "They always tell you. But David's the only young boy I ever knew with any brains that isn't scared."
"Shut up," David said. "You're just a creature of your imagination."
"Mr. Davis and I are always scared," Andrew said. "It's possibly our superior intelligence."
"You're going to be careful, Davy, aren't you?" Thomas Hudson said.
"Naturally."
Andrew looked at Roger and shrugged his shoulders.
This ends Disc 2.
Chapter 7.
Down along the reef where they went for underwater fishing on that day, there was the old iron wreck of a steamer that had broken up, and at high tide the rusty iron of her boilers still showed above the sea. Today the wind was in the south, and Thomas Hudson anchored in the lee of a patch of reef not too close in, and Roger and the boys got their masks and spears ready. The spears were very primitive, and of all sorts, and these spears were made according to Thomas Hudson's and the boys' individual ideas. Joseph had come along to scull the dinghy. He took Andrew in with him, and they started for the reef while the others slipped over the side to swim.
"Aren't you coming, Papa?"
David called up to his father on the flying bridge of his fishing boat. The circle of glass over his eyes, nose, and forehead, with the rubber frame pressed under his nose into his cheeks and tight against his forehead, held tight into the flesh by a rubber strap around the back of his head, made him look like one of the characters in those pseudoscientific comic strips.
"I'll come over later on." "Don't wait too long until everything gets spooked."
"There's plenty of reef. You won't work it all over."
"But I know two holes that are out beyond the boilers that are wonderful. I found them the day we came alone. They were so untouched and full of fish, I left them for when we would all be here."
"I remember. I'll come over in about an hour."
"I'll save them for when you come," David said,
and started to swim after the others, his right hand holding the 6-foot ironwood shaft with the hand-forged, twin-pronged fish grains fitted to the end and made fast with a length of heavy fishing line. His face was down in the water, and he was studying the bottom through the glass of his mask as he swam. He was an undersea boy, and now that he was so brown and that he was swimming with only the wet back of his head showing, he reminded Thomas Hudson more than ever of an otter. He watched him swim along, using his left arm and kicking with his long legs and feet in a slow, steady drive and occasionally, and each time much, much longer than you thought it would be, lifting his face a little to one side to breathe. Roger and his oldest boy had swum out with their masks up on their foreheads and were a long way ahead. Andrew and Joseph were over the reef in the dinghy, but Andrew had not gone overboard yet. There was only a light wind,
and the water over the reef looked light and creaming, with the reef showing brown and the dark blue water beyond. Thomas Hudson went below to the galley where Eddie was peeling potatoes over a bucket held between his knees. He was looking out of the porthole of the galley toward the reef.
"Boys oughtn't to scatter," he said. "Ought to keep close to the dinghy."
"Do you think anything would come in over the reef?"
"Tide's pretty well up. These are spring tides."
"The water's awfully clear," Thomas Hudson said.
"Bad things in the ocean," Eddie said. "This is a tough ocean around here if they get to smell that fish."
"They haven't got any fish yet."
"They'll get them soon. They want to get those fish right into that dinghy before any fish smell or any blood smell trails on that tide."
"I'll swim out."
"No, you holler at them to stay close together and keep the fish in the dinghy."
Thomas Hudson went up on deck and shouted what Eddie had said to Roger. He held up his spear and waved that he had understood. Eddie came up into the cockpit with the pot full of potatoes in one hand and his knife in the other.
"You take that good rifle, the little good one, and get up on the top side, Mr. Tom," he said. "I just don't like it. I don't like the boys out there in this tide. We're too close to the real ocean."
"Let's get them in."
"No, chances are I just get nervous. Bad night last night anyway. I'm fond of them like they're my boys, and I worry the hell about them."
He put the pot of potatoes down.
"Tell you what let's do. Start her up, and I'll get the anchor up, and we'll run in closer to the reef and anchor. She'll swing clear with this tide in the wind. Let's put her right in."
Thomas Hudson started the big motor and went up to the flying bridge and the topside controls. Ahead, as Eddie got the anchor up, he could see them all in the water now, and as he watched, David came up from underwater with a fish flopping on his spear that he held high in the air, and Thomas Hudson heard him shout for the dinghy.
"Put her nose right against the reef," Eddie called from the bow where he was holding the anchor.
Thomas Hudson came up slowly to almost touch the reef, seeing the big brown coral heads, the black sea urchins on the sand, and the purple sea fans swaying toward him with the tide. Eddie heaved the anchor, and Thomas Hudson came astern on the engine. The boat swung off, and the reef slid away. Eddie paid out line until the rope came taut, and Thomas Hudson cut the motor, and they swung there.
"Now we can keep an eye on them," Eddie said, standing in the bow. "I can't stand worrying about those kids. Ruins my damn digestion, bad enough the way it is now."
"I'll stay up here and watch them."
"I'll pass you up the rifle and get the hell back to those potatoes. The boys like potato salad, don't they, the way we fix it?"
"Sure, Roger too. Put in plenty of hard-boiled egg and onion."
"I'll keep the potatoes good and firm. Here's the rifle."
As Thomas Hudson reached for the rifle, it was chunky and heavy in its clipped sheep-wool-lined case that he kept saturated with fiend oil to keep the sea air from rusting it. He pulled it out by the butt and slid the case under the decking on the flying bridge. It was a 256 Mannlicher Schoonauer with the old 18-inch barrel they weren't allowed to sell anymore. The stock and forearm were browned like a walnut nut meat with oil and rubbing, and the barrel, rubbed from months of carrying in a saddle bucket, was oil slick without a spot of rust. The cheek piece of the stock was worn smooth from his own cheek, and when he pulled back the bolt, the revolving magazine was full of heavy-bellied cartridges with a long, thin, pencil-shaped metal-cased bullet with only a tiny exposed lead tip. It was really too good a gun to keep on a boat, but Thomas Hudson was so fond of it, and it reminded him of so many things, so many people, and so many places that he liked to have it with him, and he had found that, in the sheepskin case, once the clipped wool was well impregnated with the fiend oil, the rifle was not harmed at all by the salt air. A gun is to shoot, anyway, he thought, not to be preserved in a case, and this was a really good rifle, easy to shoot, easy to teach anyone to shoot with, and handy on the boat. He had always had more confidence shooting it, as to being able to place his shots at close and moderate range than any other rifle he had ever owned, and it made him happy to pull it out of the case now and pull back the bolt and shove a shell into the breech. The boat lay almost steady in the tide and the breeze, and he slipped the sling of the rifle over one of the levers of the topside controls so that the rifle hung there handy and lay down on the sunning mattress on the flying bridge. Lying on his belly to brown his back, he looked out to where Roger and the boys were spearfishing. They were all diving, staying down varying lengths of time and coming up for air to disappear again, occasionally coming up with fish on the spears. Joseph was sculling from one to another to take the fish off the spear points and drop them into the dinghy. He could hear Joseph shouting and laughing and see the bright color of the fish, red or red with brown speckles or red and yellow or striped yellow. As Joseph shook them off the spears or pulled them loose and tossed them back into the shade under the stern of the dinghy. "Let me have a drink, Eddie, will you please?" Thomas Hudson called down over the side. "What's it to be?" Eddie stuck his head out of the forward cockpit. He was wearing his old felt hat and a white shirt, and in the bright sun his eyes were bloodshot, and Thomas Hudson noticed he had mercurochrome on his lips. "What did you do to your mouth?" he asked him.
"Some sort of trouble last night. I just put that on. Does it show bad?"
"It makes you look like some back island whore."
"Ah, hell," said Eddie. "I just put it on without looking at it in the dark, just by the feel. Do you want a drink with coconut water? I got some water coconuts."
"Very good.
Want a Green Isaac special?"
"Fine, make it a special." Where Thomas Hudson lay on the mattress, his head was in the shade cast by the platform at the forward end of the flying bridge where the controls were. And when Eddie came aft with the tall, cold drink made of gin, lime juice, green coconut water, and chipped ice, with just enough Angostura bitters to give it a rusty rose color, he held the drink in the shadow so the ice would not melt while he looked out over the sea.
"Boys seem to be doing all right," Eddie said. "We got fish for dinner already."
"What else will we have?"
"Mashed potatoes with the fish. Got some tomato salad, too, that potato salad to start with."
"Sounds fine. How's that potato salad?"
"It isn't cold yet, Tom."
"Eddie, you like to cook, don't you?"
"Damn right I like to cook. I like going in a boat and I like to cook. What I don't like is rows and fights and trouble."
"You used to be pretty good at trouble, though."
"I always avoided it, Tom. Sometimes you can't avoid it, but I always tried to."
"What was it last night?"
"Nothing."
He didn't want to talk about it. He never talked about the old days, either, when there'd been plenty of trouble. "All right, what else is there to eat? We have to feed them up. They're growing boys."
"I made a cake at the house and brought her, and there's a couple of fresh pineapples cold in the ice. I'll slice them up."
"Good. How will we have the fish?"
"Any way you want it. Let's see what the best is of what they get, then cook it how they and you and Roger want it. David just got a good yellow tail. He had another one, but he lost it. This one's a bit flaggy. He's getting far out, though. He's still got the fish, and Joe's to hell over toward Andy with the dinghy."
Thomas Hudson put the drink down in the shade and stood up.
"Jesus Christ," Eddie said. "There it comes."
Out across the blue water, showing like a brown dinghy sail and slicing through the water with heavy, tail-propelled, lunging thrusts, the high triangular fin was coming in toward the hole at the edge of the reef where the boy with the mask on his face held his fish up out of the water.
"Oh, Jesus," Eddie said. "What a son of a bitch in hammerhead. Jesus, Tom, oh, Jesus."
Thomas Hudson remembered, afterwards, the main impression he had was the great height of the fin, the way it turned and swung like a hound on a scent, and the way it knifed forward and still seemed to wobble. He had the 256 up and shot just ahead of the fin. The shot was over and threw a spurt of water, and he remembered the barrel was sticky with oil. The fin went right on weaving in.
"Throw him to goddamn fish!" Eddie yelled to David
and jumped off the back of the house down into the cockpit. Thomas Hudson shot again and was behind with another spurt of water. He felt sick at his stomach, as though something had hold of him inside and was gripping him there. And he shot again, as carefully and steady as he could, knowing fully what the shot meant. And the spurt of water was ahead of the fin. The fin kept right on with the same awful motion. He had one shot now, no extra shells, and the shark was about 30 yards from the boy, coming in with the same slicing motion. David had the fish off the spear and in his hand. The mask was up on his forehead, and he was looking steadily toward the shark coming. Thomas Hudson was trying to be loose but steady, trying to hold his breath and not to think of anything but the shot, to squeeze and keep just a touch ahead and at the base of the fin, which was wobbling more now than it had at the start, when he heard the submachine gun start firing from the stern and saw water start to spout all around the fin. Then it clattered again in a short burst, and the water jumped in a tighter patch right at the base of the fin. As he shot, the clatter came again, short and tight, and the fin went under, and there was a boil in the water, and then the biggest hammerhead he had ever seen rose white-bellied out of the sea and began to plane off over the water crazily on his back, throwing water like an aquaplane. His belly was shining an obscene white, his yard-wide mouth like a turned-up grin, the great horns of his head with the eyes on the end spread wide out as he bounced and slid over the water. Eddie's gun rapping and ripping into the white of his belly, making black spots that were red before he turned and went down, and Thomas Hudson could see him rolling over and over as he sank.
"Get those goddamn kids in here!" he heard Eddie shouting. "I can't stand this sort of thing!"
Roger had swum fast toward David, and Joseph was pulling Andy into the dinghy and then sculling out toward the other two.
"Goddamn," Eddie said. "Did you ever see such a hammerhead? Thank God they show on the surface when they hook up. Thank God for that. The bastards always get on top. Did you see him go?"
"Give me a box of shells," Thomas Hudson said. He was shaky and hollow, sick feeling inside. "Come on in here," he shouted. They were swimming alongside of the dinghy, and Roger was pushing David up over the gunwale.
"They might as well fish," Eddie said. "Any shark in the ocean will go for him now. He'll cow the whole ocean up. Did you see him go on his back, Tom? And then that damned roll. Jesus, what a hammerhead. Did you see the kid with the fish ready to throw him? That's my Davy boy. Oh, what a old Davy boy."
"They better come in."
"Sure they better. I was just talking. They'll come in. Don't worry, they won't come in."
God, it was a terrible thing. "Where did you have that gun?"
"Commissioner made some trouble about me having it ashore, so I've been keeping it in the locker under my bunk."
"You certainly can't shoot it."
"Hell, who couldn't shoot it with that shark going toward that old Davy boy waiting there quiet with that fish to throw, looking straight out where the shark was coming? Hell, I don't care if I never see anything else in my goddamn life."
They came up over the side, out of the dinghy. The kids were wet and very excited, and Roger was very shaken. He went over and shook hands with Eddie, and Eddie said,
"We never should have let them get out like that on this tide."
Roger shook his head and put his arm around Eddie.
"My fault," Eddie said. "I was born here. You're estranged. It wasn't your fault. I'm the one that's responsible."
"You lived up to your responsibilities all right," Roger said.
"Hell," Eddie said. "Nobody could miss him at that range."
"Could you see him, Dave?"
Andrew asked very politely. "Only his fin till just at the end. Then I could see him before Eddie hit him and he went down and then came out on his back." Eddie was rubbing him with a towel, and Thomas Hudson could see the goose pimples still over his legs and back and shoulders.
"I never saw anything like when he came out of the water and started to go on his back," young Tom said. "I never saw anything in the world like that."
"You won't see a lot of things like that," his father told him.
"He must have weighed 1,100 pound, Eddie said. "I don't think they make a bigger hammerhead. Jesus, Roger, did you see that fin on him?"
"I saw it," Roger said. "Do you think we can get him?" David asked.
"Hell no," Eddie said. "He went down rolling over and over to hell knows where. He's down in 80 fathoms and the whole ocean will eat on him. He's calling them up now."
"I wish we could have got him," David said.
"Take it easy, Davy boy. You got the goose flesh on you still."
"Were you very scared, Dave?" Andrew asked.
"Yes," David told him.
"What were you going to do?"
Tom asked very respectfully.
"I was going to throw the fish to him," David said, and as Thomas Hudson watched him, the little sharp wave of pimples spread over his shoulders. "Then I was going to hit him in the middle of his face with the grains."
"Oh, hell," Eddie said, and he turned away with the towel. "What do you want to drink, Roger?"
"Have you got any hemlock?" Roger asked him.
"Cut it out, Roger," Thomas Hudson said. "We were all responsible."
"Irresponsible. It's over."
"All right.
I'll make some gin drinks," Eddie said. "Tom had a gin drink when it happened."
"It's still up there."
"It won't be any damn good now," Eddie said. "I'll make you a fresh one."
"You're pretty good, Davy," young Tom told him very proudly.
"Wait till I tell the boys about this at school."
"They wouldn't believe it," David said. "Don't tell them if I'm going there."
"Why?" young Tom asked.
"I don't know," David said. Then he started to cry like a little boy.
"Oh, shit.
I couldn't stand it if they didn't believe it."
Thomas Hudson picked him up and held him in his arms with his head against his chest, and the other kids turned away, and Roger looked away, and then Eddie came out with 3 drinks with his thumb in one of them. Thomas Hudson could tell he'd had another one below.
"What's the matter with you, Davy?" he asked.
"Nothing."
"Good," Eddie said. That's the way I like to hear you talk, you damn old son of a bitch. Get down and quit blubbering and let your old man drink.
David stood there standing very straight. Is it okay to fish that part in low tide? He asked Eddie.
Nothing will bother you, Eddie said. There's more rays, but nothing big will come in. They can't make it at low tide.
Can we go at low tide, Papa?
If Eddie says so, Eddie's a boss man.
Hell, Tom,
Eddie said, and he was very happy. His mercurochromed lips were happy, and his bloodshot eyes as happy as eyes could be.
Anybody couldn't hit that damn no-good hammerhead with one of those things ought to throw the damn thing away before he'd get in trouble with it.
You hit him plenty, Thomas Hudson said. You hit him wonderfully. I wish I could tell you how you hit him.
You don't have to tell me, Eddie said. I'll see that old evil son of a bitch going on his back the rest of my life. Did you ever see anything look more evil?
They sat there, waiting for the lunch, and Thomas Hudson was looking out to sea, where Joseph had sculled out to where the shark had gone down. Joseph was looking over the side of the dinghy into a water glass.
Can you see anything?
Thomas Hudson called to him.
Too deep, Mr. Tom. Went right down over the shelf. He's laying on the bottom now.
I wish we could have gotten his jaws, young Tom said. Wouldn't you like to have them all bleached and hanging up, Papa?
I think they would give me bad dreams, Andrew said. I'm just as glad we haven't got them.
They'd be a wonderful trophy, young Tom said. That would be something to take to school.
They'd belong to Dave if we had them, Andrew said.
No, they'd belong to Eddie, young Tom said. I believe he'd give them to me if I asked him for them.
He'd give them to Dave, Andrew said.
I don't think maybe you should go out again so soon, Dave, Thomas Hudson said.
It won't be till plenty of time after lunch, David said. We have to wait for the low tide.
I mean, gogglefish so soon.
Eddie said it was all right, I know, but I'm still pretty spooked.
But Eddie knows.
You wouldn't like to just not go as a present to me?
Certainly, Papa, if you want. But I love it underwater. I guess I love it more than anything, and if Eddie says...
Okay, said Thomas Hudson, people aren't supposed to ask for presents anyway.
Papa, I didn't mean it like that. I won't go, if you don't want me to. Only Eddie said...
What about a moray? Eddie mentioned morays.
Papa, there's always morays. You taught me not to be afraid of morays and how to handle them and how to watch out for them and the kind of holes they live in.
I know, and I let you go out there where that shark came.
Papa, we were all out there. Don't make yourself some sort of special guilt about it. I just went out too far, and I lost that good yellowtail after I'd speared him, and he bloodied the water, and that called the shark.
Didn't he come just like a hound, though? Thomas Hudson said. He was trying to get rid of the emotion. I've seen them come at really great speed like that before. There was one that used to live off Signal Rock that used to come that way on the smell of a bait. I'm very ashamed I couldn't hit him.
You were shooting awfully close to him, Papa, young Tom said.
I was doing everything but hit him.
He wasn't coming for me, Papa, David said. He was coming for the fish.
He'd have taken you, though, Eddie said.
He was setting the table.
Don't ever fool yourself, he wouldn't, with that fish smell on you and the blood in the water. He'd have hit a horse. He'd have hit anything. Good God, don't talk about it. I'll have to have another drink.
Eddie, David said, will it really be safe on the low tide?
Sure, didn't I tell you so before?
You aren't making some sort of a point, are you? Thomas Hudson asked David. He had stopped looking out across the water, and he was all right again. He knew that what David was doing was what he should do, no matter why he was doing it, and he knew he had been selfish about it.
Papa, all I mean is that I love it better than anything else, and it's such a wonderful day for it, and we never know when it might blow.
And Eddie says, Thomas Hudson interrupted.
And Eddie says, David grinned at him.
Eddie says, to hell with all of you. Come on and eat it up now before I throw it to hell overboard.
He stood there with the bowl of salad, the platter of brown fish, and the mashed potatoes.
Where's that Joe?
He went out to look for the shark.
He's crazy.
When Eddie went below and young Tom was passing the food, Andrew whispered to his father,
Papa, is Eddie a rummy?
Thomas Hudson was serving the cold, marinated potato salad covered with rough ground black pepper. He had shown Eddie how to make it the way they used to make it at the Brasserie Lip in Paris, and it was one of the best things Eddie made on the boat.
Did you see him shoot the shark?
I certainly did.
That isn't the way rummies shoot. He put some salad on Andrew's plate and took some for himself. The only reason I asked is because from where I'm sitting, I can see in the galley, and I've watched him take about 8 drinks out of a bottle since we've been sitting here.
That's his bottle, Thomas Hudson explained, and helped Andrew to some more salad. Andrew was the fastest eater he had ever seen. He said he'd learned it at school.
Try and eat a little slower, Andy. Eddie always brings his own bottle on board. Nearly all good cooks drink a little. Some drink quite a lot.
I know he had 8. Wait, he's taking 9 now.
Damn you, Andrew, David said.
Cut it out, Thomas Hudson said to both of them. Young Tom broke in. Here's a fine, wonderful man saves your brother's life, and he just takes a drink, or a few drinks, and you call him a rummy. You aren't fit to associate with human beings.
I didn't call him one. I just asked Papa to know if he is one. I'm not against rummies. I'd just like to know if a man is or not.
I'm going to buy Eddie a bottle of whatever it is he drinks with the very first money I get, and I'm going to drink it with him, young Tom said grandly.
What's that?
Eddie's head showed in the companionway, with the old felt hat pushed onto the back of it, showing the white above the sunburnt part of his face and a cigar sticking out of the corner of his mercurochromed mouth.
Let me catch you drink anything but beer, I beat the hell out of you, all 3 of you. Don't you talk about drinking. Do you want more mashed potatoes?
Please, Eddie, young Tom said, and Eddie went below.
That makes 10,
Andrew said, looking down through the companionway.
Oh, shut up, horseman, young Tom said to him. Can't you respect a great man?
Eat some more fish, David, Thomas Hudson said. Which is that big yellowtail?
I don't believe he's cooked yet.
I'll take a yellow grunt, then.
They're awfully sweet.
I think spearing makes them even better if you eat them right away because it bleeds them.
Papa, can I ask Eddie to have a drink with us? Young Tom asked.
Sure, Thomas Hudson said.
He had one, don't you remember? Andrew interrupted. When we first came in, he had one, you remember?
Papa, can I ask him to have another one with us now and to eat with us?
Of course, Thomas Hudson said.
Young Tom went down below, and Thomas Hudson heard him say, Eddie, Papa says, would you please make a drink for yourself and come up and have it with us and eat with us?
Hell, Tommy, Eddie said. I never eat at noon. I just eat breakfast and at night.
What about having a drink with us?
I had a couple, Tommy.
Will you take one with me now and let me drink a bottle of beer with you?
Hell yes, said Eddie.
Thomas Hudson heard the icebox open and close.
Yes to you, Tommy.
Thomas Hudson heard the 2 bottles clink. He looked at Roger, but Roger was looking out at the ocean.
Here's to you, Eddie, he heard young Tom say. It's a great honor to drink with you.
Yeah, Tommy, Eddie told him. It's an honor to drink with you. I feel wonderful, Tommy. You see me shoot that old shark?
I certainly did, Eddie. Don't you want to eat just a little something with us?
No, Tommy, true.
Would you like me to stay down here with you so you wouldn't have to drink alone?
Hell no, Tommy. You aren't getting mixed up on anything, are you? I don't have to drink. I don't have to do anything except cook a little and earn my goddamn living. I just feel good, Tommy. Did you see me shoot him? True.
Eddie, it was the greatest thing I ever saw. I just asked if you wanted somebody so as not to be lonesome.
I never been lonesome in my life, Eddie told him. I'm happy and I got here what makes me happier.
Eddie, I'd like to stay with you anyway.
No, Tommy. Take this other platter of fish up and go up there where you belong.
I'd like to come back and stay.
I ain't sick, Tommy. If I was ever sick, I'd be happy to have you sit up with me. I'm just feeling about the goddamn best I ever felt ever.
Eddie, are you sure you've got enough of that bottle?
Hell yes. If I ever run out, I'll borrow some of Roger's and your old man's.
Well, then I'll take the fish up, young Tom said. I'm awfully glad you feel so good, Eddie. I think it's wonderful.
Young Tom brought the platter of yellowtail, yellow and white grunts, and rock hind up into the cockpit. They were scored deep in triangular cuts across their flanks so the white meat showed, and fried crisp and brown, and he started to pass them around the table.
Eddie said to thank you very much, but he'd had a drink, he said. And he doesn't eat lunch. Is this fish all right?
It's excellent, Thomas Hudson told him.
Please eat, he said to Roger.
All right, Roger said. I'll try.
Haven't you eaten anything, Mr. Davis?
Andrew asked.
No, Andy.
but I'm going to eat now.
Chapter 8. In the night, Thomas Hudson would wake and hear the boys asleep and breathing quietly, and in the moonlight he could see them all and see Roger sleeping too. He slept well now and almost without stirring. Thomas Hudson was happy to have them there, and he did not want to think about them ever going away. He had been happy before they came, and for a long time he had learned how to live and do his work without ever being more lonely than he could bear. But the boys' coming had broken up all the protective routine of life he had built, and now he was used to its being broken. It had been a pleasant routine of working hard, of hours for doing things, places where things were kept and well cared for, of meals and drinks to look forward to, and new books to read and many old books to reread. It was a routine where the daily paper was an event when it arrived, but where it did not come so regularly that its non-arrival was a disappointment. It had many of the inventions that lonely people use to save themselves and even achieve unloneliness with, and he had made the rules and kept the customs and used them consciously and unconsciously. But since the boys were here, it had come as a great relief not to have to use them. It would be bad, though, he thought, when he started all that again. He knew very well how it would be. For a part of a day, it would be pleasant to have the house neat and to think alone and read without hearing other people talk, and to look at things without speaking of them and work properly without interruption. And then he knew the loneliness would start. The three boys had moved into a big part of him again that, when they moved out, would be empty, and it would be very bad for a while. His life was built solidly on work and on living by the Gulf Stream and on the island, and it would stand up all right. The aids and the habits and the customs were all to handle the loneliness, and by now, he knew he had opened up a whole new country for the loneliness to move into once the boys were gone. There was nothing to do about that, though. That would all come later, and if it was coming, there was no good derived from any fearing of it now. The summer, so far, had been a very lucky and good one. Everything had turned out well that could have turned out badly. He did not mean just spectacular things like Roger and the man on the dock, which could have come out very badly, nor David and the shark, but all sorts of small things had come out well. Happiness is often presented as being very dull, but, he thought, lying awake, that is because dull people are sometimes very happy, and intelligent people can and do go around making themselves and everyone else miserable. He had never found happiness dull. It always seemed more exciting than any other thing and capable of as great intensity as sorrow to those people who were capable of having it. This may not be true, but he had believed it to be true for a long time, and this summer they had experienced happiness for a month now, and already in the nights, he was lonely for it before it had ever gone away. He knew almost what there is to know about living alone, and he had known what it is to live with someone that you loved and that loved you. He had always loved his children, but he had never before realized how much he loved them and how bad it was that he did not live with them. He wished that he had had them always and that he was married to Tom's mother. Then he thought that was as silly as wishing you had the wealth of the world to use as intelligently as you could, to be able to draw like Leonardo or paint as well as Peter Bruegel, to have an absolute veto power against all wickedness and be able to detect it infallibly and always justly when it starts and stop it with something as simple as pressing a button and while doing all this to always be healthy and to live forever and to not decay in mind nor body. That was what he thought tonight would be some good things to have. But you could not have them any more than you could have the children, nor that who you loved could be alive if who you loved was dead or gone out from your life. Out of all the things you could not have, there were some that you could have, and one of those was to know when you were happy and to enjoy all of it while it was there and it was good. There were many things that made it for him when he had it, but just now, in this month, four people made it something that was as good in some ways as what the one person had once been able to make, and so far there had been no sorrow. There had been no sorrow at all. He did not even mind being awake now, and remembered how it had been once when he had not been able to sleep and had lain in the night thinking about how he had lost the three boys and the fool he had been. He had thought how he had done things because he could not help them, or thought he could not help them, and had moved from one disastrous error of judgment to another that was worse.
Now he accepted that as past, and he was through with remorse. He had been a fool, and he did not like fools, but that was over now, and the boys were here, and they loved him, and he loved them. He would let it go at that for now. They would go away at the end of their stay, and he would have the loneliness again, but it would only be a stage on the way until they came back. If Roger would stay and work and keep him company, it would be much easier, but he never knew about Roger nor what he would do. He smiled in the night, thinking about Roger. Then he pitied him until he thought how disloyal it was and how Roger would hate pity, and he stopped it, and, hearing them all breathing quietly, he went to sleep. But he woke again when the moonlight came on his face, and he started to think about Roger and the women he had been in trouble with. He and Roger had both behaved stupidly and badly with women. He did not want to think of his own stupidity, so he would think of Roger's. "I won't pity him," he thought, "so it is not disloyal. I have been in enough trouble myself, so that it is not disloyal to think about Roger's trouble. My own is different because I only really loved one woman and then lost her. I know well enough why. But I am through with thinking about that, and it would probably be well not to think about Roger either. But tonight, because of the moonlight, which, as always, would not let him sleep, he thought about him and his serious and comic troubles. He thought about the last girl Roger had been in love with in Paris when they had both lived there, and how very handsome and how very false he thought she was when Roger had brought her to the studio. For Roger, there was nothing false about her. She was another of his illusions, and all his great talent for being faithful was at her service until they were both free to marry. Then, in a month, everything that had always been clear about her to everyone who knew her well was suddenly clear to Roger. It must have been a difficult day when it first happened, but the process of seeing her clearly had been going on for some time when Roger had come up to the studio. He had looked at the canvases for a while and spoken critically and very intelligently about them. Then he said, "I told that Ayers I wouldn't marry her." "Good," Thomas Hudson had said. "Was it a surprise?" "Not too much. There had been some talk about it. She's a phony." "No," Thomas Hudson had said. "How?" "Right through, any way you slice her." "I thought you liked her." "No, I tried to like her. But I couldn't make it except at the start. I was in love with her." "What's in love?" "Well, you ought to know." "Yes," Thomas Hudson had said. "I ought to know." "Didn't you like her?" "No, I couldn't stand her." "Well, why didn't you say anything?" "She was your girl, and you didn't ask me." "I told her, but now I have to make it stick." "You better pull out." "No," he said, "let her pull out. I only thought it might be simpler. This is my town as much as it is hers." "I know," Thomas Hudson had said. "You fought that one out too, didn't you?" Roger had asked. "Yes, you can't win on any of them, but you can fight them out. Why don't you just move your quartier?" "I'm all right where I am," Roger had said. "I remember the formula. Je me trouve très bien ici et je vous prie de me laisser tranquille." "It starts with je refuse de recevoir ma femme," Roger had said, "and you say it to a Hussier. But this isn't a divorce, it's just breaking up." "But isn't it going to be hard on you seeing her?" "No, it's going to cure me. That and hearing her talk." "What about her?" "She can figure that out for herself. She's figured plenty out in the last 4 years." "Five," Thomas Hudson had said. "I don't think she was doing so much figuring the first year." "You better clear out," Thomas Hudson had said. "If you don't think she was figuring the first year, you'd better go a long way away." "She writes very powerful letters. Going away would be worse, no. I'm going to stay here and go on the town. I'm going to cure it for keeps." After he and this girl split up in Paris, Roger was on the town, really on the town. He joked about it and made fun of himself, but he was very angry inside for having made such a profound fool of himself, and he took his talent for being faithful to people, which was the best one he had, next to the ones for painting and writing and his various good human and animal traits, and beat and belabored that talent miserably. He was no good to anyone when he was on the town, especially to himself, and he knew it and hated it, and he took pleasure in pulling down the pillars of the temple. It was a very good and strongly built temple, and when it is constructed inside yourself, it is not so easy to pull down, but he did as good a job as he could. He had 3 girls in a row, no one of whom Thomas Hudson could be more than civil to,
and the only excuse for the last two might have been that they reminded him of the first one. The first one came right after the one he had just broken up with, and she was sort of a world low for Roger, although she went on to have a very successful career both in and out of bed, and got herself a good piece of one of the third or fourth biggest fortunes in America, and then married into another. She was named Tanis, and Thomas Hudson remembered how Roger could never hear it without wincing, and he wouldn't say it. No one ever heard him say the name. He used to call her Bitchy the Great. She was dark, with a lovely skin, and she looked like a very young, well-groomed, fastidiously vicious member of the Cenci family. She had the morals of a vacuum cleaner and the soul of a paramutual machine, a good figure, and that lovely, vicious face, and she only stayed with Roger long enough to get ready for her first good step upwards in life. She was the first girl that had ever left him, and that impressed Roger so that he had two more that looked almost enough like her to be members of the same family. He left both of them, though, really left them, and Thomas Hudson thought that made him feel better, though not a hell of a lot better. There are probably politer ways and more endearing ways of leaving a girl than simply, with no unpleasantness and never having been in any row, excusing yourself to go to the men's room at 21 and never coming back. But, as Roger said, he did settle the check downstairs, and he loved to think of his last glimpse of her, sitting alone at the corner table in that decor that suited her so and that she loved so well. He planned to leave the other one at the Stork, which was the place she really loved, but he was afraid Mr. Billingsley might not like it, and he needed to borrow some money from Mr. Billingsley. "So where did you leave her?" Thomas Hudson had asked him. "At El Morocco, so I could always remember her sitting there among those zebras. She loved El Morocco, too," he said, "but I think it was the cub rune that was graven on her heart." After that, he got mixed up with one of the most deceptive women Thomas Hudson had ever known. She was a complete change from his last three Cenci or Park Avenue Borgia types in looks. She looked really healthy and had tawny hair and long, good legs, a very good figure, and an intelligent, lively face. Though it was not beautiful, it was much better looking than most faces, and she had beautiful eyes. She was intelligent and very kindly and charming when you first knew her, and she was a complete rummy. She was not a lush, and her alcoholism had not showed yet, but she was just at it all the time. Usually you can tell someone who is really drinking by their eyes, and it always showed in Rogers immediately, but this girl, Kathleen, had really beautiful tawny eyes that went with her hair and the little pleasant freckles of health and good nature around her nose and her cheeks, and you never saw anything in them of what was going on. She looked like a girl who was sailing regularly or living some sort of very healthy outdoor life, and she looked like a girl who was very happy. Instead, she was just a girl who was drinking. She was on a very strange voyage to somewhere, and for a while, she took Roger with her. But he came up to the studio Thomas Hudson had rented in New York one morning with the back of his left hand covered with cigarette burns. It looked as though someone had been putting butts out by rubbing them against a tabletop, only the tabletop was the back of his hand. "That's what she wanted to do last night," he said. "Have you got any iodine? I didn't like to take those things into a drugstore." "Who's she?" "Kathleen, the fresh outdoor type." "You had to participate. It seemed to amuse her, and we're supposed to amuse them." "You burned pretty badly." "Not really, but I'm going to get out of this town for a while." "You'll be taking yourself along wherever you go." "Yes, but I won't be taking a lot of other people I know with me." "Where are you going to go?" "Out west for a while." "Geography isn't any cure for what's the matter with you." "No, but a healthy life and plenty of work won't hurt. Not drinking may not cure me, but drinking sure as hell isn't helping any now." "Well, get the hell out, then. Do you want to go to the ranch? Do you still own it?" "Part of it." "Is it all right if I go out there?" "Sure," Thomas Hudson had told him. "But it's rugged from now on until spring, and spring isn't easy." "I want it to be rugged," Roger had said. "I'm going to start new again." "How many times is it now you've started new?" "Too many," Roger had said, "and you don't have to rub it in." So now he was going to start new again, and how would it turn out this time? How could he think that wasting his talent and writing to order and following a formula that made money could fit him to write well and truly?
Everything that a painter did or that a writer wrote was a part of his training and preparation for what he was to do. Roger had thrown away and abused and spent his talent. But perhaps he had enough animal strength and detached intelligence so that he could make another start. Any writer of talent should be able to write one good novel if he were honest, Thomas Hudson thought. But all the time that he should be training for it, Roger had been misusing his talent, and how could you know if his talent still was there, to say nothing of his métier, he thought. How can anyone think that you can neglect and despise or have contempt for craftsmanship, however feigned the contempt may be, and then expect it to be at the service of your hands and of your brain when the time comes when you must have it? There is no substitute for it, Thomas Hudson thought. There is no substitute for talent either, and you don't have to keep them in a chalice. The one is inside you. It is in your heart and in your head and in every part of you. So is the other, he thought. It is not just a set of tools that you have learned to work with. It is luckier to be a painter, he thought, because you have more things to work with. We have the advantage of working with our hands, and the métier we have mastered is an actual, tangible thing. But Roger must start now to use what he has blunted and perverted and cheapened, and all of it is in his head. But, au fond, he has something fine and sound and beautiful. That is a word I would need to be very careful of if I were a writer, he thought. But he has the thing that is the way he is, and if he could write the way he fought on the dock, it could be cruel, but it would be very good. Then if he could think as soundly as he thought after that fight, he would be very good. The moonlight did not shine on the head of Thomas Hudson's bed anymore, and gradually he stopped thinking about Roger. Thinking about him doesn't do any good. Either he can do it or he can't. But it would be wonderful if he could do it. I wish that I could help him. Maybe I can, he thought, and then he was asleep.